NATO stands with Turkey today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. NATO backs Turkey after a Russian warplane is shot down near the border with Syria.
It's a little bit of a mystery what happened there up in the sky. And the Turks say they gave repeated warnings before firing. The Russians say that, you know, that their plane was clearly on the Syrian airspace.
Also, why the French are putting more police officers on the streets.
They suffered a tremendous intelligence failure. They simply failed to see what was coming.
Plus, life in the Muslim gray zone.
Muslims are the primary victims of ISIS. They're the primary resistors of ISIS. And now they're also the people who are also being blamed and confused with ISIS.
Those stories coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and on The World today, the fight against ISIS is front and center at the start of our show, but also at the White House, where President Obama welcomed French President François Hollande today. Obama made it clear that in the wake of the Paris attacks, the U.S. shares France's determination to destroy ISIS.
This barbaric terrorist group, ISIL or Daesh, and its murderous ideology poses a serious threat to all of us. It cannot be tolerated. It must be destroyed. And we must do it together.
The president also spoke about that Russian warplane that was brought down today by the Turkish military. Obama said Turkey has the right to protect its airspace. The Russian jet was operating along the border between Syria and Turkey. The Turks said it crossed over into Turkish airspace and failed to respond to repeated warnings. The Russians say it was flying over Syria. This incident could have broad implications for the larger conflict in Syria. We'll hear what this means for NATO in a moment. First, though, let's head to Moscow and check in with reporter Charles Maines. Charles, how is Russia responding to this strike?
Well, as you noted, they've mentioned from the very beginning that the plane, the Russian plane, was actually in Syrian airspace. They're sticking to that story. And in fact, we had comments by President Putin just a few hours ago calling this essentially a knife in the back of the Russian Federation. He called this, the destruction of this plane, a crime. You know, and he also went on to kind of explain that Turkey had been essentially aiding and abetting ISIS with the sale of oil, which was financing ISIS through this whole process. And finally, he's just saying that, you know, essentially this was something that the Russians weren't interested in any kind of conflict with Turkey or NATO per se. And again, calling for this kind of international coalition, which has been sort of a theme here of recent weeks.
You know, Charles, a lot of people have worried that one of the risks of many countries operating with the same mission in the Mideast, but not especially coordinated, that allies, if we can call Turkey and Russia allies, might shoot each other out of the sky. Who in Russia is saying, "I told you so"?
Well, there are certainly all the military analysts have been talking about this for a while. I mean, it's a little bit of a mystery what happened there up in the sky. As you mentioned, the Turks say they gave repeated warnings before firing. The Russians say that, you know, that their plane was clearly on the Syrian airspace. The Kremlin is saying they're waiting for NATO to kind of make their assessments of the situation. But, you know, it's worth pointing out that, you know, the Russia and NATO have been having these kind of skirmishes, or like quasi-skirmishes, I suppose you'd call them, over the past year. In the wake of Ukraine, you know, Russia's been testing sort of the boundaries of international airspace, probing countries in Eastern Europe, the Baltics, Scandinavia. And essentially what they do is that they're flying missions where they go dark. They turn the transponders off. And so when you talk to defense experts over just even the past year, they've always said this was a possibility. And as you note, you know, the skies of Syria are very crowded these days.
Yeah. And what about the fact that Russia has both been in this position before as a victim, shall we say, and it's also widely suspected to have shot down other planes itself? Is that being addressed in Russia? I trust if it is, somewhat delicately.
Well, somewhat delicately. And I think, you know, again, the focus right now is, of course, on, you know, this act, which the Russians have called a crime. I think there's also a sense that, you know, certainly among more sort of hawkish circles here, that there should be some kind of response. But I think, you know, the message seems to be here that Russians are really pivoting towards this, like, let's work together. They're certainly going to have to kind of address this issue with the Turks. And there are, of course, economic interests as well. The Russians are building a pipeline to Turkey, which was sort of their answer in the wake of Ukraine to try and get around some sanctions in terms of getting gas back to Europe. So, you know, they have all these sort of things coming together. But in terms of what the Russians can do now, it's really, I think their real message here is they really want to work together, and they're kind of sticking to that.
So when you say work together, you mean work better with Turkey and by extension with NATO?
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, Mr. Putin noted today that, in fact, you know, the Russian and the U.S. have what they call a deconflicting measure in place, which means they're sort of you know, military communications are going on constantly to warn each other about missions that are being flown over Syria. The sense that here after Paris, and particularly, you know, after this downing of the Metrojet Airlines, but particularly after Paris, was that they wanted to try and find a way to kind of link themselves to this wider ISIS cause, this anti-ISIS coalition. And this has to a lot to do with the fact that Russia has been so isolated over the past year because of Ukraine. And I think for them, it's important to stick to that message.
Charles Maines there in Moscow. Turkey turned to NATO for an emergency meeting today to discuss the downing of the Russian jet. Turkey is one of the 28 member states of NATO. Emergency sessions are called when one of the allies feels its security is threatened. Mark Urban is the BBC's diplomatic editor. So NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg made a statement after that special meeting, Mark. What did he have to say?
Well, the general tenor of it, Marco, was that he affirmed Turkey's right to defend itself, to defend its airspace, said that the alliance stood behind them. That was the formal statement. He also added that he had seen evidence, which I impute to be from the US, that Turkey's version of this, that warnings were given, was correct in the view of NATO as a whole.
Yeah, even though Russia maintains that its plane was flying over Syria. Given Turkey is a member of NATO, wasn't kind of Stoltenberg's comments expected? I mean, NATO is all about one for all for one.
I think that's absolutely right. NATO really could do very little other than reaffirm, as it did, the right of its members to self-defense. This is Turkey's own version of events, that Russian aircraft was in Turkish airspace for a total of 17 seconds. So some allies will be asking themselves, given all the potential regional fallout of this, whether that really was the wisest thing to do.
Russian President Putin criticized Turkey for running to NATO. Did Turkey go too big?
Well, this has been a repeated Turkish diplomatic play. We saw it a couple of years ago when Turkey was flagging up the risk of ballistic missiles coming over from Syria into Turkey. That produced all sorts of consequences, including the deployment of US, German and Dutch NATO forces with anti-aircraft missiles. We saw it also early in October when there was an earlier series of violations by Russian and Syrian aircraft that they brought the matter to a meeting of NATO. I think the Turks like that feeling of being backed up, of having friends at these difficult moments, particularly, obviously, if they think they're going to have to confront a significant military power like Russia.
So Stoltenberg is calling for calm on both sides. How likely is it that Russia will take that advice? What does Vladimir Putin mean when he says there are going to be consequences?
Well, the guidance we're hearing out of Moscow is that Russia does not plan to launch some huge military strike on Turkey. There's been some suggestions that the consequences could take the form of a tourist ban, that Russian tourists should not travel to Turkey because of a terrorist threat there. And of course, Turkey has certainly in the past few years been an extremely popular destination for Russian holidaymakers.
The common enemy for the U.S., France, Turkey and Russia is ISIS. What does this event suggest about the feasibility of those countries actually working together? Would you say this is just a rough start to the coalition, if we can call it that, or is it just the nature of this particular coalition?
Right from the start, there have been allegations from the U.S. and others that very few of the targets that Russia actually hits belong to the so-called Islamic State. Now, in the last week or two, that's changed a little. There is a recognition that Russia has been hitting more Islamic State targets, but the great majority are not on Islamic State or suspected Islamic State positions. The people who were being bombed when this incident happened were one of these Free Syrian Army affiliated groups. They're then thought to have responded by destroying a Russian rescue helicopter that had landed as part of the search for the downed pilots with a US-made TOW anti-tank missile. So you can see it's a very tricky situation to reconcile.
That was the BBC's diplomatic editor, Mark Urban. It's been said before, but the tensions between Moscow and the West do have a certain Cold War feel to them. And when you look back, most people would say the biggest Cold War scare was the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And there is a newly declassified document that reveals just how close we came to nuclear Armageddon on a much more recent occasion in the 1980s under President Ronald Reagan. The document is a top-secret report by the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, and it was obtained last month by the National Security Archive at George Washington University after a 12-year fight. The World's One Man History Desk, Chris Wolf, has been looking into this. What did you find, Chris?
Well, Marco, there was a well-documented war scare in the Soviet Union in late 1983 into 1984. And at the time, U.S. intelligence assumed it was all bluster and propaganda. But this document indicates that the Kremlin really thought the U.S. was planning a first strike on the Soviet Union and would, in fact, do so as soon as the U.S. reached a certain level of strategic military superiority.
So what triggered that fear? What was the evidence that this might happen?
Well, you got to remember the context of the time. Reagan had made the President Ronald Reagan had made the evil empire speech. He had just announced that spring of 83, the Strategic Defense Initiative, the Star Wars program. You had this massive military expansion going on with the U.S. greatly increasing the size of its forces.
And there was a massive pushback against the nuclear buildup.
Obviously, yeah. And the military mobilization included NATO allies, and yours truly as a young infantry soldier was part of that a long time ago in the British Army. Then you had the downing of the Korean airliner when it strayed into Soviet airspace and the deployment of nuclear missiles to Europe. And the clincher was this military exercise called Able Archer. And the report concluded that in 1983, we may have inadvertently placed our relations with the Soviet Union on a hair trigger.
So Able Archer, this was a U.S. military program?
It's a NATO military exercise testing readiness for a nuclear war. And the things that were different about it in 1983 was that it included originally a plan for very high-level officials to get involved, right up to the level of the president. And it also involved the use of dummy weapons that fooled Soviet spies that really thought that real nuclear weapons were being wheeled out.
But the U.S. would never have started World War III, not even under Ronald Reagan.
No, but it appears that the Soviet leadership thought otherwise. There's a quote in the report that says, "It's an especially grave error to assume that since we know the U.S. is not going to start World War III, the next leaders of the Kremlin will also believe that and act on that belief." And you have to remember, this was something I saw in a different paper by the CIA about the same period, that that generation of Soviet leaders were all traumatized by Operation Barbarossa, which was the secret surprise German invasion of the Soviet Union in World War II. But what's really scary, Marco, was the Soviets' plan of response to this threat, which would have been to launch their own preemptive strike, you know, a full-on initialization of nuclear war. And now, they would have done that if they saw what they considered these indicators of NATO military preparations happening. And they set up this computerized automated mechanism to make that determination for them. So it was something that could have been tripped accidentally.
Yeah, they kind of became numbers junkies as to how close we were to Armageddon.
Exactly.
The fog of war, the fog of Cold War, where could these assumptions have taken the world in the 1980s?
It's kind of lucky that nothing ever happened. In Exercise Able Archer itself in 83, the report concludes that as it happened, the military officers in charge of the exercise minimized the risk of an actual escalation by doing nothing in the face of evidence of Soviet counter-preparations. But they commented, these officers acted out of instinct, not informed guidance. So we were just really quite lucky about that. In due course, in his memoir, Ronald Reagan says how he eventually came to the conclusion that the Soviets really did have this very real worry, and that was when he started to ratchet back some of the aggressive preparations that NATO was making at about the same time that Gorbachev was coming in on the other side. So we never did get much further beyond like 86. Things started to calm down.
So do you see any lessons for today and some of the news we're hearing?
Well, I think, Marco, the obvious lesson that we should all draw is that you never make an assumption about what is happening on the other side of the hill. What is your enemy thinking or potential enemy? You really don't know.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolf, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coming up, the master behind one of the most audacious robbery attempts in British history, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. If you've ever been to Los Angeles, you know the city's awesome multi-culti food trucks. Those trucks are a success story for the immigrant entrepreneurs there who run them. Most immigrant entrepreneurs start with small businesses that serve their own immigrant communities, but then they often struggle to grow those businesses outside those communities. Saul Gonzalez of station KCRW introduces us to one L.A. business that's trying to break through by walking a fine cultural line.
In Los Angeles' Latino neighborhoods, it's common to see mariachis at the grand opening of a store or restaurant. Today, it's for the La Monarca Bakery and Cafe in LA's Highland Park neighborhood. It's a local chain that's growing. La Monarca specializes in traditional Mexican food like pan dulce and tres leches cake. It was founded by Ricardo Cervantes and Alfredo Livas. They're from Mexico, and they say it was their search for the authentic tastes of home that turned into a business opportunity. Here's Cervantes.
When we moved to Los Angeles, we always look for the best Mexican food. We're trying to find good food. And pan dulce is always one of those things that you grow up with. So when we tried the pan dulce that we could find, we always missed the flavor of back home. And it was a point in time when we said, why don't we do something? If we miss it so much, maybe other people do too.
But Cervantes and his partner probably aren't your idea of typical Mexican immigrants. Both come from middle-class families in Monterrey, Mexico. Both have MBAs from Stanford. And they're breaking an unwritten business rule that immigrant entrepreneurs do best by sticking to their own communities.
We wanted to do a concept that's, of course, Mexican in essence. All our products are Mexican. But we didn't want to be categorized into just Hispanic neighborhoods. We thought if we do a good quality concept, good quality product, people will like it regardless.
Jose, Americano?
Since Cervantes opened the first La Monarca Bakery in 2006 in a heavily Latino part of L.A., he and his partner have developed a bicultural business strategy, locating their bakery cafes in working-class immigrant neighborhoods and wealthier white communities like Santa Monica. To appeal to both Latinos and non-Latinos, Cervantes says La Monarca does a careful cultural balancing act, right down to its design. Each bakery's color and decor, Cervantes says, are picked to suggest Mexico, but not look too Mexican.
As you see our store, yes, you have some touches of Mexican elements, but it's not meant to detract somebody that is not Mexican from coming in, no? Some people go overboard, and it's too Mexican, and it's everything in your face, no? No? The sarapes, and so other people don't feel comfortable.
La Monarca's bicultural approach will be tested in its new location in L.A.'s Highland Park. Once mostly Latino, this neighborhood is gentrifying with younger white residents, people who might not beeline for Latino panaderia, but they might like La Monarca's exposed brick walls, modern furniture, and Wi-Fi.
What does this represent to you?
Well, it represents progress.
Andrew Barrera heads up the neighborhood Chamber of Commerce. He says La Monarca is a perfect fit for the changing community.
This is right in the middle of an area which has been traditionally Latino that is growing in its diversity. And so I think they made a very brilliant move in moving here because they're getting both an existing customer base as well as a new evolving customer base.
The bicultural bakery chain is also catching the attention of business and political leaders on both sides of the border, like Carlos Sada, Mexico's consul general to L.A.
This is one of the shops of one of the most important businessmen that Mexico has here in L.A.
Sada says the success of Ricardo Cervantes and his partner shows a different side of the Mexican immigrant experience that should be highlighted.
We need to do more because there are so many Ricardos, so many people like this guy, that are talents, but it is not well known. And I think it is perhaps part of the fault of the Mexican government not to promote the way it should be promoted.
As for La Monarca's future, Ricardo Cervantes will push to grow the business in L.A. and elsewhere.
Yeah, build as many stores as we can in California first, Los Angeles, and at some point then go to Mexico. And now the business goes from Mexican founders that started in the U.S. to operate also in Mexico, no?
You're going to export yourself back to Mexico.
Exactly. Exactly.
For the world, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
Yeah, some people don't like to work so hard, and that's what this next story is about. Prosecutors say it was the biggest burglary in English history. It happened a few months ago in a part of London called Hatton Garden. Thieves using drills broke into a vault full of safety deposit boxes, and they made off with millions of dollars worth of cash, jewelry, and other valuable stuff. Now the trial of some of those involved in the heist is underway in London. The World's Leo Hornack has been following the trial. What do we know about this crime, Leo, the biggest burglary in English history?
Well, Marco, according to the prosecution, at least, this was a heist unlike any other. They estimate that around £14 million, that's about $21 million worth of goods, jewellery, cash, etc., were stolen. And what's remarkable is that a lot of the valuables that went missing are still missing, including precious stones, gold, platinum. It's very difficult to trace a lot of this stuff because the nature of safety deposit boxes is that the owners are not obliged to list what valuables are in the box in the first place. According to the prosecution, at least, this was a crime that was planned over several years. They used a special diamond tip drill to cut through the concrete in the vault to reach into it.
Doesn't just happen in the movies, huh?
Well, quite. And they spent several days in the vault taking stuff out. It was over a national holiday. So a pretty ambitious crime.
What do we know about the accused, the people on trial?
Well, again, according to the prosecution, and nothing is proved yet, this was a group of old-timers, both in criminal terms and in age. And the youngest of the accused is in his 40s, but two of the oldest are in their 70s. One of them, he's 76 years old, Brian Reeder. According to the prosecution, he was known as the governor or the master, and he was someone who had an extensive criminal past. According to the prosecution, at least, another of the accused, Daniel Jones, was found, or at least was discovered to have a book called Forensics for Dummies in his home. At Reeder's house, at the master's house, a book on the gem underworld, a diamond tester, a diamond gauge, and magazines about diamonds.
Those are some tantalizing details. How is this trial been received in the UK?
Well, it's huge here, Marco. And I have to say, I'm not completely surprised, because if there's one thing that the UK tabloid press loves, it's a heist. And quite apart from whether the people accused in this trial had any involvement in this at all, this crime has begun to obsess the British media and many people in Britain. And there's a long history of this kind of interest in large crimes. A few years ago, we had the Millennium Diamond Heist, as it was called in the press, which was a similarly ambitious crime that also went wrong. And going back further, you know, anyone in Britain will know the phrase the Great Train Robbery, which was a crime committed in the early 1960s. And these were criminals who were active, you know, 50 years ago. They're still not forgotten in these neighborhoods where they came from.
The World's Leo Hornack, thank you so much for giving us a small taste of the hype. I'm starting to feel it myself.
Thank you very much, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. Brussels is on day four of a tense security lockdown, and Belgians are dealing with it by tweeting pictures of cats.
We always love to take things not too seriously. We always find time to make a joke about it and to put things down to earth.
That story is coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. France was America's first ally. President Obama reminded us of that this afternoon in his joint press conference with French President François Hollande. The two leaders met primarily to talk about joining forces against ISIS. But Obama also noted the solidarity many Americans are feeling with France right now in the wake of the Paris attacks.
We've never forgotten how the French people stood with us after 9/11, and today we stand with you. Nous sommes tous français.
Even during Hollande's visit to Washington, back in France, a state of emergency remains in effect. Police there are still investigating the November 13th attacks and conducting raids to root out any suspected extremist activity. Vivian Walt writes for Time magazine from her home in Paris. The numbers are pretty stark, Vivian. More than 1,000 police searches, more than 100 people taken into custody, more than 100 interrogations. How legal are these raids that French police are conducting during the state of emergency?
Well, and you left out one figure, which is that more than 10,000 cops have been deployed to the streets of Paris. So there is an enormous amount of firepower being unleashed on the streets of Paris and the rest of France right now. It is entirely legal under the state of emergency, which has been in effect since immediately after the attacks, the night of the attacks, and will be in effect, in fact, for the next 3 months. So the police at this point have free rein to do whatever they deem is necessary in order to confront whatever national security threats they think are out there.
I mean, that number, perhaps of people accept that because of fears right now. It's really what's going on behind the scenes with these people being brought into custody, those who aren't. I hear 4 times a day they need to report to their local commissariat to let them know they're around. I mean, tell us more about what's going on behind the scenes that number just doesn't really reveal.
Well, if you speak to Muslims around Paris, and there are many, many of them all over Paris, they will tell you right away that this has a direct and immediate impact on their life. First, the house arrests that have come into play since the November 13th attacks. The folks that are under house arrest, and as far as we know, there are about 266 of those, are really unable to do anything in their life because they're constantly under police surveillance. And as you say, they have to report to the police several times a day. And so you have a situation where you're really guilty before proven innocent. Now, for most non-Muslim French people, I think this is quite an acceptable level of security given the shock and the trauma that's been inflicted on the country. But this is a very divided place right now because really virtually 100% of those who are targets of the police action are Muslim. And if you're not Muslim, you're pretty much exempt from the whole state of emergency.
So the French government has something called the S file. It's a list of those people who are registered as possible threats in France and apparently all the participants in all the major terrorist attacks in Paris are on this list. Is that who police are targeting with these raids, or is this kind of the moment when French officials are saying, spread the net wider?
Well, they're certainly spreading the net wider for very good reason. They suffered a tremendous intelligence failure on November 13th. That there's no other way to interpret this. They simply failed to see what was coming. They feel like this is the only thing they can do is to cast a very wide net to roll up whatever remnants of the network are out there and to see that it doesn't happen again.
So the other side of this security versus civil liberties debate is civil liberties. What are the critics saying?
Well, the critics are saying what we've done is essentially a rubber stamp a police state in France, something that is absolutely counter to French values, to everything that this country is supposed to stand for, liberty, equality, fraternity. And this is a period in which all of those values appear to have gone out the window. This is essentially what civil liberties lawyers are saying, what the representatives of Muslim associations are saying. The problem is that the shock has been intense enough for most of the country to say, okay, we know we're trampling on civil rights at the moment, but let's get through this phase. Let's then rebuild on a better basis, but that the far worse alternative is another attack.
Time Magazine's Vivian Walt there in Paris. Vivian talked about the pressures facing Muslims living in France. Moroccan-American author Leila Lalami feels those pressures as well. She says in an increasingly polarized world, it's difficult for Muslims like herself who choose to live in what ISIS propaganda calls the gray zone. I'll let Leila Lalami describe what that means.
The gray zone is what ISIS calls the space inhabited by any Muslim who doesn't subscribe to their ideology. And it's actually interesting because they quote Osama bin Laden, who said that George W. Bush was right in the way that he also viewed the world, in this sort of either you're with us or you're against us sort of view. And so the gray zone is that space that Muslims inhabit that are not on the side of ISIS.
And you personally, I mean, are you determined to stay in this so-called gray zone?
I mean, I think that all of our lives are gray. I think this really comes down to questions of identity. And I think, unfortunately, in a view like ISIS's, there can only be one identity, which is this identity that you have as a Muslim fighting the infidel. And that's it. And you can't have any other identities. And that's just foolish, because all of our identities, all of us, regardless of whether you are a believer or unbeliever, are mixed. They're not just one thing. And in the case of Muslims, there's obviously all kinds of other identities, racial, ethnic, linguistic, national, right? And so in my case, when I look at my life, my entire life is gray. I mean, I was born in Morocco, but I also went to French school, and I came to my love of literature through the French language. And now I live in California, and I teach at UC, and I write books in English. And my social circle, when I look around me, my friends are from all kinds of different religions or no religion at all. And so all of our lives, in a sense, are gray. And so what's disheartening is that when you see that language come out of ISIS, and to see it also reflected by some of our political leaders, it's very, very frightening.
Elaborate on that, that some of the kind of attitudes, positions they have, ISIS have, are shared by some of our leaders.
Well, I mean, if you look at what's been happening in the last 2 or 3 weeks with the Syrian refugee crisis and the uptick in rhetoric against them, people who are seeking the highest office in the land. So you're looking at people like Donald Trump or Ben Carson or even Ted Cruz, who cannot make a simple distinction between someone who's fleeing ISIS and Assad, and that would be a Syrian refugee, and ISIS itself. They really can't make a distinction between Islam and ISIS. They can't make a distinction between Muslims and terrorists. And as long as those distinctions are blurred, then that is going to create a climate in which Muslims are going to feel very unwelcome in the West. And that is precisely what ISIS is counting on. So it's really kind of terrifying that Muslims are the primary victims of ISIS. They're the primary resistors of ISIS. And now they're also the people who are also being blamed and confused with ISIS by our political leaders.
Yes. So with the Paris attacks, what does it mean for the presence of the gray zone? Are gray lives like yours the target now?
After every single terrorist attack, you see the exact same pattern, which is, why aren't Muslims condemning terrorism? This despite the fact that Muslim organizations and individual Muslims do this all the time, all the time. And yet the calls persist. So it's almost like we're caught in a loop of like, oh, why aren't you doing something about this? Which is strange, because no one is asking young white men to condemn gun violence, even though the vast majority of gun violence is perpetrated by young white men. And that's because our views of young white men are very complex. We understand that each young white man is responsible for his actions. Whereas when you look at the case of Muslims, they're held collectively responsible for all of their actions. So you're basically turning your greatest ally against yourself, and you're retreating into these black and white zones. And there's never going to be any winning going that way. And this has been going on since the September 11th attacks, this pattern. And my fear is that we simply cannot seem to find a way out of it, that all that continues to happen is this sort of retreating into the sides, and nobody's willing to engage in the middle.
Leila Lalami, born in Rabat, Morocco. She's now based in Santa Monica, California. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
A quick update now on a story we told you about yesterday. It was about ordinary Canadians who volunteer to help resettle Syrian refugees. Canada had planned to admit some 25,000 of them by the end of the year. The government said today they're about 2 months behind schedule, and they will not be taking in unaccompanied men. Only women, children, and families will be allowed in. Tomorrow we'll head back to Ontario to hear how Muslims there are feeling after several hate crimes targeted their community.
We're mobilizing. What this does, this anger and this a bit of fear, turns into mobilization for Muslim women.
That's tomorrow here on The World. This fall, thousands of students in South Africa have protested against the high cost of a college education in their country. The financial burden is especially heavy for young black South Africans who have to support their extended families. It's such a widespread phenomenon that some in South Africa call it the black tax. Sarah Birnbaum has a story from Cape Town.
Diana Matumba grew up in Limpopo, one of the poorest regions in South Africa. There are no paved roads. It's a struggle to find a place to make a phone call. Diana says you can't even find her village on the map.
You find people still live in very tiny houses, and most of them are doing odd jobs, and most of them are farmers. That's how they sustain a living.
Diana has traveled the 1,200 miles from Limpopo to the elite University of Cape Town. Diana's entire family, her aunts, her uncles, cousins, grandparents, all chipped in to pay her tuition.
I was like, you guys don't understand. It's expensive, and we need to get... And they said, you know what, go there, do what you love, pass, please pass, we will sort it out.
Now Diana is about to graduate, and she's getting huge pressure from home to find a well-paying job so she can subsidize her relatives who work so hard to put her through college.
There is an expectation. There's something that in South Africa we call black tax. Basically, it means that most black children, because your family is not well off, they send you to school so that you become well off, then you can help sustain them.
Diana says she wants to go to graduate school next year, but she feels compelled to get a job now to help her mom build a house, for instance.
That's the one thing I think about when I go to work, is I need to give back to my family.
Some South Africans say the black tax is a myth, but University of Cape Town sociologist Jeremy Seekings has found racial differences when it comes to family expectations.
It's very clear that there are patterns of obligation and responsibility amongst black South Africans are much more wide-ranging than amongst white South Africans.
Black South Africans are more likely to grow up in an extended family household, which means more relatives to take care of. But beyond that, there's the entrenched inequality, poverty, and high unemployment that disproportionately affect black South Africans. So there tends to be more need and potentially more pressure. Londa Nxumalo grew up on a family compound in KwaZulu-Natal with her siblings, grandparents, four aunts, and many cousins. Londa says when she started working, the requests for money started pouring in.
And it could be anything. I mean, it could be that there's a situation and there's a young person who needs to be put through school. It could be that someone's lost their job and therefore a household doesn't have an income anymore and we need to chip in so that they can survive and eat until the breadwinner gets a job. Could be because people make bad decisions, get themselves into debt or into trouble, and you know, you have to help them pull them out of the hole that they've gotten themselves into.
Londa says it got to be too much, and she's not alone. Anthropologists and sociologists say that black South African millennials are starting to take the once rare step of hiding income from their relatives. Londa even left the country for a while. Now she's back, living hundreds of miles away from her family in Cape Town.
I choose to tell very few people about the details of my financial situation. It just suits me to have people in the dark because I don't want me being open to abuse.
But then there are people like Zimbini Ogle. She's 29 and taking care of her extended family, but she refuses to give up on her goals. Zimbini worked her way up from a poor, remote town to a middle-class life as a consultant and clinical psychologist. Now she counsels rape victims and helps match young people with careers. She's starting her own charity and getting her PhD, flying all over the world to present her research.
I take my laptop with me wherever I go. I feel like every minute I have, I need to work on a chapter, I need to do something, I need to be reading an article.
Zimbini also supports her mother and her sister's three kids. When she talks about her niece and nephews, her face lights up.
I want to be there for them, whatever they want to be in life, and I have big dreams for them.
She also has big dreams for herself. So with or without a black tax, she won't give up on either. For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, Cape Town, South Africa.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. Here in the U.S., we respond to medical emergencies in a certain way. A premium is placed on rushing patients to a hospital. It's similar in other countries, but not always. The emergency response in Paris after the terrorist attacks there was different from what we saw here in Boston after the marathon bombings. My colleague here at WGBH, Craig LaMolt, explains.
Isabel Catala was home in Paris watching the France-Germany soccer game on TV when it was interrupted by news of the attacks.
I'm an ER doctor working in Paris for 20 years.
She called the emergency room to see if she should come in. They didn't end up needing her, but she wrote an article later for the website Medscape about how the emergency response worked that night. Rather than automatically racing victims to the ER, first responders set up what they call an advanced medical post near the Bataclan concert hall where most of the victims were.
You stop everything and you put it in the middle of the street.
They divided victims into three categories based on the severity of their injury, sending the most serious cases to operating rooms or emergency departments. And the people who weren't as seriously injured were treated right there in the street.
And you say, please do not go to the hospital. They get too many people really injured, so please do not go to the hospital. Go tomorrow.
She acknowledges they may have lost some time getting the most serious cases into the OR, since victims were first taken from several attack sites to that field hospital in the street. But French emergency responders are especially well-equipped to work in the field. That's because they've got a different way of doing things. The U.S. model is often called scoop and run. Basically, get the patients to the ER as quickly as possible. The French model is referred to as stay and play. When you call the French version of 911, the emergency system there, known as SAMU, sends a doctor in the ambulance.
It's the hospital coming to your house. And the SAMU can stay in your house for hours just in order to treat you right on site and then bring you to the hospital, which is a totally different thing from the U.S.
8 minutes after the first bomb went off, we had our first patient already.
Maureen McMahon is the director of emergency preparedness at Boston Medical Center. She was here the day they rushed victims of the Boston Marathon bombing into the operating room.
Because the definitive care was the ORs. They had to stop the arterial bleeds. And that couldn't really be done as effectively in the field as it could be, or in the emergency room as it could be in an operating suite.
Since the Boston bombing was at the Marathon, the response was actually similar to Paris in that there was a medical tent there triaging patients.
The difference, though, would be what do we do with the lesser injured?
Dr. Ricky Q of Boston Medical Center was in the tent that day and says they tried to minimize patients' time there.
So if that meant taking some of the minor injured or lesser acute patients and still transporting them to get them seen but to get them off the immediate area, that was one of the other goals we had in mind that day.
Dr. Brian Barneywald is the chair of emergency medicine at Tufts Medical Center.
It's amazing that on that day, every patient who made it to a hospital survived. And I think that speaks volumes for the trauma system in Boston.
And for the U.S. emergency system in general. The director of the Center for Disaster Medicine at Mass General, Paul Bittinger, is careful not to criticize the French first responders. But he says their system is probably not right for the U.S.
It's much more resource intensive, and philosophically, many of us believe it does not produce better outcomes.
Bittinger says there needs to be more research about which model of response is better.
Probably not surprisingly, when we don't have data, the debates are very fierce because it's hard to tell who's right.
Although the attacks in Paris and Boston were quite different, the truth is there are probably more similarities in the medical response to them than there are differences. But doctors in Boston say it's in really looking at the differences and at what worked better that we can figure out the best response and be as ready as possible if something were to happen here that's even worse than what we've already seen. For The World, I'm Craig LaMolt in Boston.
Today was day four of a security lockdown in Brussels, Belgium. It's serious stuff. The authorities are still looking for a suspect linked to the Paris attacks. They've even asked Belgians to refrain from tweeting about any police activity they might witness. And in response, Belgians have flooded Twitter with pictures of kitties. Yep, they're posting mocking photos of cats shooting guns, cats in disguise, cats with their paws in the air. This does not surprise Willem de Grave. He co-directs the Belgian Center for Comic Strips in Brussels.
We Belgian people, we always love to take things not too seriously. And when there is something happening, we always find time to make a joke about it and to put things down to earth.
It's interesting. Even the Belgian police force responded with a picture of a bowl of cat food, thanking all the Belgian cats for their support during the lockdown. Is this about humor or is it about spontaneity, kind of just getting the timing right with this stuff?
I think it's something more. We Belgian people, we don't like that much authority. We are not a nation of superstars. We prefer that everybody is on the same level. And that's the same for police, in fact. Although they are there to control and to protect us, they still are considered to be human peoples, just like everybody. The fact that they can find time in very serious situations for a joke tells a lot about our mentality.
Is that attitude helping kind of Belgium, Brussels get back to normal, even though there's a, you know, we're in day four of this lockdown? I guess it is going to be mostly lifted tomorrow. But is that helping people kind of readjust and find a sense of normalcy?
I think so, because some situations, you have two options. You can cry and become depressed, or you can just accept and make the best of it. And it some kind of reassure me that even now there is time for humor.
So as a co-director of the Belgian Center for Comic Strips, I mean, let's remember, Belgium is a country that gave the world Tintin and the Smurfs. I got to say, aside from Professor Calculus and his bumbling character, Tintin isn't really humorous. But where does the big tradition of cartooning come from in Belgium?
Belgium, it's a small country. We only have 11 million inhabitants, but we are quite a complex country. We have three official languages. We have Dutch, French, and a little bit of German. And besides, in our history, Belgium was almost the whole time occupied by other nations. At one period were the Spaniards ruling here, then it were the Austrians, then the Dutch, then the French. This had many consequences. Communication was always tough and complicated in our regions. We think that people here, they understood very quickly that communication with images was so much more efficient than communication through text, communication through words. Comics, of course, it's a perfect example of visual communication.
Wow, that's fascinating. What about the cat tweets? Have you seen one that you really like?
I think my favorite one is the mixture between a cat and a painting of René Magritte. René Magritte is one of our most famous painters. He was a surrealist painter. And the tweet of which I'm talking about is a painting of Magritte where you see a hat. And on the tweet now, there is coming a cat outside of the hat. It was very funny, and it was a really nice reference to our cultural history.
One of my favorite painters, I guess, Ceci n'est pas un chat, doesn't really work.
yes.
Willem de Grava co-directs the Belgian Center for Comic Strips in Brussels. Thanks very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure, Marco.
And that's all from us. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.